You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Tess Gallagher, the author most recently of At the Owl Woman Saloon, and she is the author primarily of seven books of poetry, beginning with Instructions to the Double, Under Stars, Willingly, Amplitude. Most recently, her book Portable Kisses was expanded. She wrote another book of short stories, Lover of Horses, and a book of essays and interviews on poetry called A Concert of Tenses. But today we're primarily going to be talking about her new book of fiction, At the Owl Woman Saloon. Now, the thing that I noticed most immediately is that the first thing that happens in the book, having been prepared to enter a saloon, we enter a salon, a beauty salon, and there are transformations throughout on things of the sort. History gives way to personal history. Owls appear, but not necessarily hoot owls. They appear as parts of expressions. So I wanted to ask you first about the title and that revivification of the mythology of the West.
Yes, I love this idea of putting these contemporary stories up against what was the Wild West. And I also like that kind of jazz slip note of saloon, salon, and how that sort of woke up the whole idea of what the salon was, both the artistic salon, which is my book of the stories, that display, and also the salon, which is the beauty parlor, where we go in to be transformed.
Now, this is a book of stories, but in a way, it's something else as well, because threaded between the stories are excerpts, tiny bits, of books from the history of the Old West and the women of the Old West, but also lore about hummingbirds, and then strange found bits as well. And I wondered if you could talk about how they structure the book.
Well, I've always been fascinated with hummingbirds, and there's one particular passage in there which talks about the sounds that hummingbirds make, that what we hear is we can't really hear the true sound. What we're hearing is a kind of overtone of the undertone. And so maybe that relates back to saloon, salon. Mm-hmm. You know, that when I say saloon, we hear the undertone of salon. Also, hummingbirds, they can be very rambunctious and fractious during the daytime. But when they go to sleep, even if they've been very hateful toward the other hummingbirds and territorial, they go to sleep next to each other. So I'm kind of interested in that communal activity of theirs.
It seems to me that in many of these stories by my guest Tess Gallagher in At the Owl Woman Saloon, publisher Scribner, there is that quality of what is on the surface and what is underneath. And so in my own favorite story in the book, which is The Leper, the woman is dusted with flour, which she thinks makes her a leper in a certain visual way. But underneath, she feels that her isolation from the world, the degree to which she's being excluded from life, people are coming and delivering plants, a funeral happens, she gets a call from a suicidal friend, a husband is busy clicking in the background demanding that she get off the phone. There's a sense of being isolated from the world around her, a leper in that sense. Mm-hmm. And the stories seem to work in that way, to have an undertone or undertow of meaning. Is that the process of writing itself that delivers those meanings? How do they arrive? How does the writing of a story take place for you typically?
Well, it may start with somebody telling me something, actually, or something that happened to someone and I witness it. Each story has its own different starting point. The first story just started with me going to the beauty salon and suddenly finding men on either side of me. and I thought back to a time when that wouldn't have been usual. And these were both elderly men, and they were getting their hair done. And the one began to talk loudly enough that I kind of surfed on his conversation. And then he actually began to talk to me.
Now tell me, what is Owl Woman?
The Owl Woman was a Papago healer, a Native American healer, and she used to get her songs from the dead. That was the report. And so I liked that name very much, and I liked her name, and I liked what she did. And I liked this idea of getting your songs from the dead, and of also signaling in the title a spiritual dimension to the book, so that the book had that hum, that kind of undertone again.
Mm-hmm. Is that, for you, this relaying of voices from the dead? Because I know that over the years in your poetry, you wrote a suite of poems for your father, for your dead father, mm-hmm. and of course there's been a book of poems about the death of your life partner, Ray Carver. Mm-hmm. The bringing to a vocalization of the missing spirit.
Yes, I feel like those spirits are present, and they really do inform us. I'm informed by my missing spirits, and in that sense, they're not missing. And so I wanted the book to reflect that, and there to be an awareness of that in the stories.
I'm talking to Tess Gallagher, and I wanted to enter not the subject of Ray Carver, but the subject of writing around and with another writer. I always felt as I was reading Carver's work that I was reading someone who was trying to find the essence of what a story is, not to speak of minimalism, but rather what is the minimum amount of plot and information that needs to be placed in to make it a story rather than an incident or an anecdote. And one of the things I came to the conclusion about was that there's the arrival of the secondary meaning, the feeling that although the surface is very specific and very clear and life's miseries are being delineated, there's a moment at which the whole situation turns what? Emblematic, metaphorical, a figure for itself. Yes,
to
the story
mm-hmm.
speaks rather than the character of the person.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I wondered to what extent, you know, because you must have been in conversation every mm-hmm. day about writing.
He didn't talk theoretically at all. I mean, I think he uses the process that a lot of writers do use of just approaching and reapproach. I mean, my stories, for instance, I've gone 60 and 70 times over these stories. And he wouldn't know what a story was about and, in fact, did rely quite a lot on me to verbalize what I thought was happening there.
As you were reading his work?
Yes, as I read the drafts.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think he'd had anybody to do that. I mean, I think other editors may have lashed around over his terrain, but I don't think he had anybody to articulate what was mattering in the story.
And did he do that for you as well?
He couldn't do the big overall thing that I did, but he was, you know, when I looked at his work, he would say, well, write that out. How should it be, you know? And so then I would lash it out. I would really draft it. And he would sometimes use whole chunks, full scale, of what I had drafted. If they worked, I said, your story generated that, it wouldn't have happened otherwise, so just take it. And so we didn't have, I mean, the whole idea of authorship I hope this isn't to be considered trespass on anybody's sense of what it is, but with us it was a companioning, and we did listen very carefully to what the other person said and take work from each other, took titles, took the writing out of what would work. He didn't do that as much. He would be more prone to say, well, your character is too nice. Uh-huh. You need more tension, so make that character a little nasty or something. Give them a little edge. He might say something like that.
There is a tone of hopefulness by the end of this book, At the Owl Woman's Saloon by Tess Gallagher. It is the sense of a prayer at the end of the book about to be answered. And a suggestion, unless I'm a very odd reader, of the efficacy of prayer.
Yes, that even if you don't know whether it's going to be answered or not, that the activity of prayerfulness in one's being is very helpful to you and helpful to others.
Now, it's been mentioned by one of the people who've written about the book that the stories seem to go in pairs or to answer one another. And so the last two stories, one is about the human being as Buddha, but these Buddhas are rather mean Buddhas. They're bump into each other in the supermarket Buddhas.
Uh-huh. They're scrabbling with each other.
But the other possibility suggested by the last story is that of opening the door to perpetual prayer, as if life itself were a form of worship. Mm-hmm. And the woman in that story, the praying woman, who is a dog cutter, another of the figures of these saloon people and the salon people and the people who are working transformations on a girl who's going to a prom and mm-hmm. various figures who occur. She comes upon the secret letters that her husband has received from a lover, and they've had such a companionable marriage mm-hmm. that instead of confronting him, she starts to include more and more and more in her prayers mm-hmm. until what he answers at the end of the story is not her confrontation, but her acceptance and her silence.
Yes. Yes, you got that story very well. Yeah. And also he in a certain way isn't his revelations to her about what happened aren't really so necessary. She's already in a state of forgiveness before the fact almost. You know, she's done what she had to do. She's gotten through her anger. She's burned the letters. And she's in a mindfulness that is so large. Of the people around her, and that's been the strange side benefit, really a centralizing of her being towards the world and community around her.
Now, in the early days of feminism, that would never have been the answer, and a woman
no.
reading that story would grow very angry. Obviously,
yes.
something has occurred. Could you speak about that story in particular, but also the book in general? It seems to be a constant rethinking and adaptation of certain themes
yes.
that have emerged in your work over the years, some of them having to do with feminism.
Well, in my generation, you were asked really to be a double. You were supposed to also be very feminine. That's what you got from the generation of women you were raised with and by. And then you were also supposed to be this efficient person who could earn living and raise family and so on. And it's a really a huge task, and you can't manage it finally. All of that. So you have to make some choices. I think people who have read the story you're talking about, young women, get really angry, and they sometimes get stuck there. You know, why doesn't this woman take a hand with this man? You know, kick him out and so on. And the kind of wisdom and patience and going inward that she has, they haven't come to in themselves. So I don't know if, I think feminism has changed out there, though, and that, at least for myself, I'm in this other, less reactive place, so that I can find a lot of the answers in myself without feeling I have to necessarily change the whole world, because I've seen that, for one thing, isn't possible. My experience has been that things are quite much where they were in some important dimensions for women.
My sense is that many of these stories are about the aftermath of death, the aftermath of various deaths, but in particular the death of Ray Carver. And my sense of you as a couple, because I had heard the two of you read together in Los Angeles at the Beyond Baroque Literary Arts Center, was that you had begun to become a very public kind of couple. And in the wake of it, there seems to have been a decision to not be so public, to attend to one's own work, as if that were the better choice.
Yes, well, I have done that very much. I left my teaching at Syracuse and went home to the Northwest in 1989, and I've been there. Working on that book, Moon Crossing Bridge. It was the first book I wrote after Ray's death, and then Portable Kisses came at right on the heels of that, almost overlapping that. So I really made a choice for my writing, and even though it concerned Ray and coming, really binding him back into my life in a particularly strong way in those poems, those were my poems, mm-hmm. and my work. And then I got the chance to have time to write this book by virtue of the Lyndhurst grant. It gave me 3 years in which to work, and so I really concentrated on that. I still do a lot of work on Ray's writing. I've written all the introductions for all the posthumous books, and last fall we did a wonderful book of his in Great Britain, which is his collected poems, and that was called All of Us, and that was very important for me to do, to see his poems come all together like that. So he's very much in my days and my heart and life, but I'm doing also what he would want me to do, not just because he would want me to do it, but that's also important to have that permission in my river. That big fish of Ray saying, go for it, babe, you know, that he wouldn't want me, just doing his things and minding his store. I met Valerie Elliott in Sligo.
You did.
Elliott's widow in July in west of Ireland, and you know that is what she does, and that is satisfying to her, but she isn't a writer. And that would have been to be kind of buried alive for me. And it wouldn't have been honoring those things Ray himself honored, or that we honored together, and that I as an individual need.
In the book, you have an answer story, in a sense, to one of Carver's most famous stories. His is called Cathedral. Yours is...
It's called Rain Flooding Your Campfire.
Now,
or Falling on Your Campfire.
Is
look at it.
That story a story to show how different writers use the same material? What is the impulse?
Well, again, going back to this authorial notion, I really did contribute to the original. And I don't want to say exactly what, but largely. And so in a way, I was also in dialogue with myself there. It may seem that I'm only talking to Ray, but I'm also in dialogue with an earlier contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a variation. It's to say, look... fiction is just off to the side. What happens if you just step to the side? You know, saloon, salon again.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to see what would happen if you let the woman have the epiphany in that story, and you kept the woman close to the blind man, what the story was like, instead of as it happens in Cathedral, where the two men come together.
Now, does this... Carver became such an apotheosized figure for a whole generation of writers. It was, mm-hmm. you know, in a certain sense, what seems to have happened was that there was Donald Barthelme, who had an enormous influence on a range of a certain kind of voice in American writing, and then the next major voice was Ray Carver's. When you speak of your contributions to these stories, do you disconcert that generation of writers who want to worship Ray and keep his work singular and intact?
Well, I don't think that if you see two writers working that closely together, you should make any assumption like they're making, you mm-hmm. know, because we were contributors. And, you know, I think they should just still think, you know, Ray was an amazing writer, just as I do, you mm-hmm. know. And I don't ask for any credit there. I'm just talking about it in terms of, you know, what did happen. You know, I don't need anything from it except to represent what happened. And it was a very enjoyable and wonderful time. And I think Ray was different for living with me and working with me. And I was different also. I think his work grew, if that's okay, you know, to make not his claim, but just again a statement that he did get larger. His work reached out. He didn't write just slice of life, you know, a drop off the cliff. There's that, you know, the sentences grew more complex. The stories got longer. The ability of the story to lift emotionally and spiritually also grew. And some of that was due to the fact that I would say, well, who's going to care? I don't care if you do leave the story there. You know, and mm-hmm. sort of this kind of challenging that went on behind the scenes. You know, and he was just great to take that. He wanted that. He didn't want me to say, oh, it's just great, you know, terrific. He really wanted to work.
Well, the huge difference, it seems to me, and what he seems to have gotten from you in those final stories. In fact, I think one of the reasons I like Leper so much is that there starts to occur in the story something you would never have guessed would be there from the early work, and that is visions and dreams.
Yes. No, he didn't have that. He didn't have that, and I very much had that. And he did, I think, begin to legitimately have that.
Because there's a vision of horses.
Yes.
In the story, Leper, that also, you know, there is also a vision of horses in Ray, but it seems to be very much as if, I can't explain it, but when these visions arrive, as if fiction itself, as we know it, or as the story has been telling it, is being interrupted for a broadcast from elsewhere.
Yes,
a whole different realm is being
right.
projected or received.
Uh-huh,
and that's what's so interesting in that story.
Yes, oh, thank you. Yes, and well, he in my when he looked at would look at my poems, he never liked those poems which you know, didn't let him know things very clearly and exactly. But he also liked the mystery. I mean, he had a sort of a double reaction to that. He didn't want me to have to give up my mystery, but he was always hammering for clarity at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. May I ask you something? It interested me. When I was reading the collection of essays, A Concert of Tenses, I noticed that your first teacher, in a sense, was Theodore Rethke.
Yes.
And here, too, was a man who, in his poetry, would break words to monosyllables. I remember reading a biography of Rethke, The Glass House,
yeah.
in which he said he wanted words at the point where they were losing their meaning, where the words were becoming numb and obdurate.
Yes.
And this seems to be a quality of Carver's early work.
Yes, and I also like that too. I like the word right on its edge, where it's in its watercolor phase, maybe.
Yeah,
things will show through.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
You don't know quite what it's going to be.
And some of that, at least in Rethke, you know, was attributed to alcoholism, the word becoming, in a sense, oracular or getting larger than the drinker.
Alchemical.
Yes. Yeah. And that seems to be the area of language that you first took up in Instructions to the Double, almost as if there were a secondary message in language beyond what the speaker could say was what he couldn't say, and that moment of transcendence to the unsaid and unsayable. Mm-hmm. And this enters Carver's work at the end, too,
yes,
it seems
right,
to me.
Right. A kind of witching, you know.
Yes.
And witching by language, you know, letting the language also lead you somewhat.
How does one do that?
Oh, it's a big act of faith, I must say. And you don't know if you're always going to get it. You know, I try to teach it, but it's the most, you know, what you do is get your student to be next to you, and then you do it, and you let them watch you do it in process, and then sometimes they can leap.
Do you have, because, you know, Rethke had said, would repeat certain words, and then also it said, like to think through, if that's the word, I'm not sure it's thing, certain poems while in hydrotherapy, that the water of the cure became the circularity that took a word outside its context and made it into an orbit. And I'm wondering if you had any personal techniques for surrendering to the auras around words.
Well, yes, they look a little stupid when you start to talk about them. I mean, very often I would just read down middles of pages so that I turned words into just matter, just chunks of stuff, you know. And then I would let myself kind of spark off the words that way. I didn't let them be in sentences, and I would skip my eyes, and that's what I call witching. You know, and then I could get combinations I couldn't get in any other way.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Tess Gallagher. Her book is At the Owl Woman's Saloon, published by Scribner's. I'm Michael Silverblatt. The show is Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.